Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening, everybody. Welcome to the every other week Tuesday night open call. Mr. Jesse, what do you got to say for yourself?
Good evening, sir. I got to say that I got wet trying to get over to my office from the house. It's raining like freaking catching dogs out of nowhere.
Yeah,
I mean, crazy
well, it's Florida, though.
Yeah,
yeah.
I mean,
well,
I
tell you what,
Cheerios.
We yeah, well, we played catch up on our rain here too. Now we're getting toasted. Somebody broke the knob on the oven, and it's stuck on high again. It was it was either 95 or 96 today. I mean, it's this ridiculous. Supposed to be mid 90s tomorrow, and then down to 90, and then we finally fall back into the 80s. Man, I'm telling
wow.
you, I'm so sick of hot weather.
I know, man. I know. I'm telling you, I feel the same exact way as you do, buddy. No doubt about it. It's nice.
Yeah. Well, you know, I mean, it's not like I'm going to do something about it other than just stay in where it's nice and
exactly.
nice and cool. At least my air conditioning is working right now. So that's a big improvement for what it was for
yeah.
quite a while.
Yeah.
But anyway, we have Terry with us and
feeling
Larry.
Good?
What's that?
I said, how are you feeling otherwise?
Well, I'm recovering. I had a little bit of a crash.
No, sir, I'm still a recovering Democrat.
Well, there's no recovery from that.
No.
See, it's like alcoholism. You can never say you're cured. You can only say you're recovering.
Yeah. And at what stage of recovery you are in, that's the million-dollar question.
Extreme. I mean, there's no going back. I can promise you that one. It's a little odd around here today. I'm tired of water. Did you ever think you'd hear me say that? From the sky. And I think my nose is getting rubbed in it because I was sitting here today and I'm looking out across the river and the first thing I noticed cheerfully, the water has gone down. It's been steadily just above my dock, just at the top of my dock for many days. They were steadily releasing the two dams upriver from us to avoid serious flooding, I'm sure. But I'm sitting here and I'm looking out and I'm like, oh, that's nice. That's good. The water's low and the water's clear. And then I'm thinking, what's wrong with this picture? I'll tell you what was wrong with this picture. The sun was out, the sky was clear, and it was pouring.
That happens here too in Florida, for sure.
I've seen that happen here in Dallas. Clear blue sky,
yeah.
And I'll get rained on.
You know, it's like na 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 na. There's the sunshine, and you don't get to use it.
That's right.
Yeah. Oh well. Well, anyway.
Sure.
We're slowly but surely getting our callers coming in. We have all our moderators here. John is with us. And, of course, Terry, who is just speaking, and Larry is with us, and Mr. Jesse. And I suppose before we forget, we better have him do the disclaimer so we don't get ourselves in a whole lot of trouble.
That's right. Guys, thank you for joining us tonight. Again, for those that are new, welcome. For those that have been around here, you know better than to come over here looking for legal advice. We don't know what that is, and we don't provide it, but we're going to have a lot of fun talking about our cases, and specifically my appeal today, which I'm going to read some of. I sent it to John and you. I don't know if you guys had a chance to read it, but it's pretty fun.
Yeah, I read through it.
It's good.
Yeah. So,
hammer them.
Again, we're going to have fun discussing our stuff, but I don't know anything about your stuff or what legal advice is. So, guys, if you're looking for that, you need to go talk to an attorney. We're just having fun here tonight. So, that being said, I'll turn it back over to the boss, Mr. Dave Mack.
the boss, yeah. Well, you asked earlier how I'm doing, how I'm feeling, and I made the comment.
Yeah, I wonder how you're feeling.
I'm doing better. I did a crash and burn a week ago Saturday, last Saturday. And just inadvertent, it happened so quick, I'm not sure exactly what happened, but I think I caught my tip of my foot of my shoe on landscape timber.
Wow.
And I was kind of hopping and leaping because it was raining out. It was raining and there was a lot of water, and I was trying to avoid a lot of water flow that was coming through, and I was going into the breezeway at the next building down, going to the mailroom. And I didn't make it. I fell forward because, like I say, it happened so quick. I don't know what happened. All I know is I hit right on the corner edge of the brick with my right side. And I'm pretty sure I broke the bottom part of my rib cage in there. Extraordinarily sore.
Jeez,
I went down. I scraped up my right arm pretty good, and I was bleeding all over the place and all that stuff. But I made my way down to the mail room and mailed my letter, went home and started doing a scrub-a-dub on my arm to clean up the blood and all that stuff. But I got a nice, great, big, huge bruise on my right side down right around the just above the hip area. So it's one of these things, you know. Like I say, that's the only thing I can figure out that happened. I mean, I'm very careful. I realize what my age is. I use a railing when I'm on stairs. You know, I'm still steady and everything, but, you know, just in case. But it was one of those things. I was just hopping to avoid the heavy flow of water through there, and evidently my foot caught that timber, and I just fell forward so fast. I hit that building and went flying into the breezeway on my back. It flipped me around, and I was on my back. But anyway, I'm. Let's just
you're lucky
say
you're
I
okay
dealt with some
is,
pretty. I'm thankful I'm okay, but I've dealt with some pretty severe pain out of this hip area, and I get some excruciating pain from time to time if I move just the right way. So I'm pretty sure I've got something that, down the bottom part of the rib cage down there that got cracked. So I'm just, you know, I'm being careful what I do, but it doesn't affect my walking. I'm able to go out and do my walks and all that stuff. I can motivate around here, take my showers. It's just that, like, if I'm taking a shower, when I go to scrub around over there, I better be real careful or it's, you know, real painful. So, you know, it's just one of the joys of living life. So other than that,
I'm
fine.
Those busted ribs, they never heal right. I had one, and that was 20 years ago, or more than 20 years ago, and I still can't lay on my left side.
Well, this is
it
on my right side,
heal
and
right.
I sleep on my right side, yeah.
That sucks.
Yeah, well, see, if you remember back several years ago, my chiropractor gave me a big go-through with x-rays and everything, and my spine is all twisted up. It's twisted to the left, twisted to the right, twisted to the front and the back. I cannot sleep on my left side for very long. I can I can try sleeping on my left side, but I wake up in about an hour, and my back really, really, really hurts. I can't sleep on my back because my back really hurts if I do that very long. So I sleep on my right side, which is the side I've slept on all my life, basically, in a fetal position. Well, this is on that side, and you can imagine how that felt the first couple, 3 days. So it's been an experience, but I'm still alive. You know, like I say, I can go out and do my walks every day, and that didn't affect anything. In fact, Sunday morning after my walk, I came back, cooled off, and went down, and we have a series of apartment complexes down here. We had these real heavy rains recently, and it washed a tremendous amount of dirt down onto the public sidewalks. I mean, inch and a half of mud four different places. Yeah, four different places, four different complexes, including the one I was in. I went down and I shoveled all that mud off those sidewalks because I got sick and tired of walking it or walking out in the street and taking a chance on getting run over. So
regardless of how fond you are of them, Dave, get rid of those clown shoes.
Yeah, well, speaking of shoes, it's funny you should mention that, Terry, because I just got a new pair of shoes out of the box today that I got to send out. I got a brand new pair of Reeboks that I'll start wearing tomorrow. But anyway, the ones I've got on now with the hole in them from my little toe worn through them because I've put so many miles on them. Yeah, they look like clown shoes. So anyway, I'm fine. I'm still alive and hopefully I'll make it to the weekend. So, well, who of our moderators has any good news? Starting with Jesse. Jesse's got some fun
stuff to
tell us about. Yeah, that's what I mean.
I don't know if this appeal, this is an interlocutory appeal, guys, which is a real, real pain in the butt to do.
Explain
Johnny
to everybody what an
before.
Interlocutory appeal is, Jesse. What that is.
Well, it's based on a regular appeal is on a final judgment. A interlocutory appeal is in the middle of the proceedings, and you don't agree with whatever ruling that judge gave on that particular situation. And that's what makes it so dang hard. Because, like, I didn't send everything to you guys, but our body and appendices is just, it's hundreds of pages. I mean, hundreds. The entire testimony is there. I mean, it's pretty crazy. So this situation, basically, the way this has happened is we sued under the FDCPA and SECPA U.S. Bank. U.S. Bank did not show up at the hearing. They never hired anybody. So then their servicer, which I also sued, but in a different county in the same small claims court, shows up, and then now they hired the attorney. U.S. Bank never to this day has hired an attorney. To help them out. So the facts here, I sued bank, and I'm just going to read it, debt for debt violations. The bank was served the usual way when it didn't appear for pretrial. The court entered a default judgment against it. The same day, Specialized Loan engaged counsel. Now, Specialized Loan Servicing is not U.S. Bank, but two different people. However, counsel did nothing in this case because it had been hired by a different entity for a different case in a different county. Indeed, counsel knew nothing of this case until the next week. U.S. Bank later moved for relief from default in this case, alleging that its failure to appear was due to its counsel being confused by the fact that another entity had other cases in other counties. In support of their argument, counsel filed for the bank. The declaration of its counsel given on knowledge and recollection. I objected to this affidavit, of course. However, the trial court accepted the bank's argument. So the question, this is a little lesson for everybody, is whether the judge and the court abused its discretion. Okay, now abuse of discretion is going flat out against the law. It's flat and simple. The courts do have abuse of discretion on certain situations, like a motion to dismiss. It could be, you know, granted or not granted. It could be, hey, let's just proceed and we'll see where this goes. Or, you know what, it's done. It didn't meet whatever rule, for instance, verification or attaching of a document to it, and the judge just disposes of it, be done with it. But either way, no side can say, oh, you abused discretion. See, that's not an abuse of discretion. But if the light was green and I ran the light and I have it on camera and it's green and the cop says, no, it was red, and I'm showing him it's green, and the judge says, well, we're still going to give you the ticket. That's abusing his discretion because the light was obviously green, and the law says I can proceed with the green. So I'm trying to simplify it all, but that's the best we can. So the question on this particular brief is whether the trial court erred in granting relief from the default, where the movement failed to offer sworn testimony in support of the excusable neglect. The second one is whether the trial court abused its discretion in granting relief from default, where the excuse for neglect did not pass the straight face test. Because I can't even say it with a straight face, right? Where the trial court erred in granting relief from default, where no meritorious defenses were offered. So we're going to skip a bunch of stuff. Defendant failed to offer evidence of neglect, right? A party moving for release must from a default must show excusable neglect and meritorious defense. The bank filed their admissible evidence, and so it claimed excusable neglect was not properly considered. Florida statute provides a testimony must be given under oath. The excusable neglect must be sworn. In review of this case, the court said that there was no abuse in accepting the unsworn representation of counsel because the other side did not object, and this was in Semek's instruction. However, had there been an objection, counsel's unsworn representation would have been insufficient to vacate the final judgment. So the court already said the other side didn't object, so they lose no matter what, and it proceeds. Well, we did object, by the way, so just so you know. A competent sworn statement can be sufficient to support relief from judgment. In our case, the bank's attorney offered a statement to the best of his knowledge and recollection. See, that's not a sworn affidavit. This is not a statement of fact under oath, but rather a statement of what the attorney believes. Courts do not accept belief on the same basis as real evidence over objection. The plaintiff made his objection in writing and orally at the hearing. It follows that the attorney's declaration was not admissible within the Florida Statute 90.605 and thus admitted it. Admitting it was an abuse of discretion, and that's the case of Yang. Belief is not evidence, which is must, another case. In that case, the defendant swore to his information and belief. The trial court rejected that testimony and gave judgment to the plaintiff. The appeals court affirmed it, reasoning that evidence under oath was required to oppose judgment. It is the error to accept belief as evidence. In this case, the plaintiff verified the based on the information and belief. The trial court accepted that as competent testimony, but was reversed because the information and belief are not admissible evidence. This is Ballinger. Our case is present. Our case presents the same issue. The defendant offered belief for its excuse. Belief is not evidence. It must. When objected to, it is not sufficient to allow it from default or allow relief. The trial court therefore abused its discretion in considering the proffered basis for relief from default and should have denied this motion. And then our second one is, of course, proffered excuses are inadequate. If the trial court could have properly considered the defendant's excuse for failure to appear, it still should have rejected it. The excuse was that the day of pretrial, a different entity hired counsel to handle a different case in a different county. This fails in two important ways. First, ignoring a summons is not excusable. And second, being confused by different cases is no excuse at all. A, the small claim summons sets forth the date and time at which the defendant must appear in order to avoid a default. In our case, the summons shows the appearance was required at 9 a.m. on May 15th of 18. It was served on April 26th and allowed plenty of time to get to the court. In small claims, a company may even send an officer or it may engage counsel. Prior to the pretrial, U.S. Bank did neither. On the day of the pretrial, a different entity, SLS, engaged Mr. Morales to defend a different action pending in a different county and did not mention this action. The actions of a different entity involving litigation in different counties cannot excuse failure to appear by U.S. Bank to justify neglect by U.S. Bank. It must show some mistake or excuse on its part. Mr. Morales' declaration fails to show that U.S. Bank hired counsel in response to the summons. Neither does it show that U.S. Bank filed papers or sent an authorized person to appear at pretrial. There is, in short, no showing that U.S. Bank did anything beyond ignoring the summons. An ignore and hope strategy is inappropriate. It says so right on the face of the summons. You know those little digs that Tanner likes to get in there? I just love
them. Yeah,
those,
I noticed
they
that.
They make me laugh. Yeah, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Oh,
I chuckled
that.
When
right?
I read
an
that.
An ignore and hope strategy is inappropriate. It says so right on the face of the summons. I like to pee my pants when I was reading this thing the day before yesterday because we do a lot of checking back and forth. Yeah. Anyway, had U.S. Bank attempted to do anything at all in response to the summons, its excuse would still fail. The proffered excuse is that a different entity, SLS, had a different suit pending with different deadlines in a different county. There are 67 counties in Florida. There are courts with clerks in each one of those counties. The bank argument is that someone was confused because there are different cases with different parties in different counties. This fails the straight face test, mostly because it proves too much. Where the 67 counties of Florida are an adequate excuse, every default judgment in the state can be set aside. So anyway, I'm going to keep going to that one. Yeah, he just likes, I mean, wow. I'm not even going to go to the meritorious defense because it's useless. So the conclusion basically is an unsworn statement for neglect was different entities had different cases in different counties. No defenses were offered. Since neither of the requirements from relief from default were met, the court must reverse and remand for the trial court to re-enter the default final judgment. So the reason that we want this, for those of you that are new to the listening audience here, is the fact that this particular judgment says right on its face that they can no longer foreclose, and it's ordered by the court. So think about what I'm telling you. I want this judgment reversed really bad because that means that they forever have to hold their peace. How do you beat that?
You got it.
Think about that. It's impossible to beat. That's pretty stout, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So
that's probably the most important small claims judgment that I've ever heard about.
Yeah, and you saw it, Dave. You guys seen it, so.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's pretty cool, you know? It's something else. Let's just put it that way. So I win that. I get that reversed. It's over. Foreclosure's over forever. Bye-bye. That's the key part to the whole thing, I think. And that's why I want it bad. So that's it.
That's understandable.
My good news.
Yeah.
Still going in there, and we're going to win this thing. That's all there is to it. Yeah.
But like you said, the appeal with all of the massive amount of paperwork and everything is just a real pain in the neck.
Oh my God! Yeah.
It's
I got an
awful lot of work.
It is. I got the
entire. But, you know, if you can get that default judgment put back into place, what's it worth to you? A lot. So
about $300,000. Yeah. Absolutely.
So, worth the effort and the time and everything else you put into it, without a doubt.
I'm taking 300 G's all day on that one. That's right.
Yeah, really. Okay, well, do any of our other moderators have any good news?
I do.
Where you at, Mr. Lair?
Speaking of appeals, I won my federal appeal, or I should say I won a partial victory on my federal appeal. There were basically three choices that the court had. One was to dismiss my appeal entirely, one was to grant it entirely, and this involves the three credit reporting agencies. And you remember our little friends at NCTUE, the one that Equifax pulls credit from at an alarming rate. Anyway, so all four of those were involved in this case. This is a case I filed last year. There were two cases against the credit reporting agencies, one I filed the year before. So because I had one case going at the same time that Equifax and TransUnion were involved in the second case, the court dismissed them due to the fact that, at least in their view, the claims are basically the same. So that was arguable, and now I've got nothing against Experian and TransUnion, but I can certainly file suit against them for more recent transgressions. And meanwhile, based on this result, and I'll tell you a little bit more about it in a second, I'm going to attack the summary judgment that Experian and TransUnion got in the 2016 case. Because this is the judge that just hates me and will find any number of ways to rule against me. So that judgment is basically void because it's so ridiculous. But we'll see what happens. But mostly, I just want to settle with these people because we're not talking about huge sums of money. $5,000, $10,000 settlements is what we're talking about. So, and you remember that according to Experian, I've cost them $800,000 so far, and I'm nowhere near done yet. So,
yeah. Hey, Larry, hang on one second. Hang on one second, would you? We got some noise in the background. It almost sounds like heavy breathing from somebody. It's just like a.
Sounded weird, right, Dave?
Yeah, I don't know what that was, but whoever was making it, would you please stop? Okay, sorry, Larry.
That's okay.
That
I guess somebody's
up.
Really excited about my appeal.
It must be.
That's what it is.
Gosh. Anyway, so the court remanded the decision against Equifax because the decision in this case was rendered in, what was it, May of last year, I think? And Equifax had been dismissed from the first case in February of last year because I failed to serve them properly, even though, you know, I sent them the waiver of service and the guy kind of said he would do it, and then he didn't, and then I served them. And then after that, the court ruled that because I served them late, it was like 2 days late or something, that they would be dismissed from the case. Which was, again, a ridiculous ruling and
right.
made no sense because right. it just dragged on everything and, you know, it was just stupid.
Yeah.
Anyway, so the appeal court agreed that just because I had previously sued Equifax doesn't mean that I can't sue them again for a different cause of action.
Mm-hmm.
Which, of course, was exactly correct ruling.
Oh, yeah.
Excellent.
Yeah,
good. So you got partial on it anyway. You may not have gotten all of it, but you got some of it.
Yeah.
Right.
And I've already told the Equifax guy, except for the polls from NCTUE, which I am obviously going to go after full force now. I don't know if anybody else has had any results in that situation. But
I haven't
they could
gone
have settled
down that road
me.
Yet.
Yeah. They could otherwise have settled with me for a very minimal amount. I mean, $5,000, which is...
Well, Larry, just so, and just for my information, what was your claim on the NCTUE thing?
Well, honestly, the claim against NCTUE was pretty weak. It was basically distribution of my credit report without permissible purpose. And that needed to be... really reinforced and rewritten, but now I'll have a chance to do that.
Is there heretofore before you, is there any real case law on that particular issue?
Well, I've settled with the credit reporting agencies for that issue, so you know.
I mean, against NCTUE.
Oh, no. Not that I'm aware of. I think they've only been
okay.
sued once. Oh, and the funny thing is that I serve them at their headquarters in Atlanta, Georgia. And in the only other case that I could find involving them, that's exactly where they were served, in Atlanta, Georgia. And they participated in the case. But then a few months later, in my case, they said that was not a proper place to serve them.
I know the person who brought that, and so do you. It's just I'm not going to go there on an open call because he can't talk about it
right
now. He's under some sort of gag order.
Yeah.
But the NCTUE, just so everybody knows, because you may not understand who that is a credit reporting agency that all of your utilities use, communications companies like cell phone companies and AT&T, your power companies, your water companies, cable, that sort of thing, which is why you rarely see that stuff on a traditional credit report, unless it's negative and it's gone to collection. People say, well, you know, they don't report you utilities, when actually, in fact, they do. It's just that they use the NCTUE as opposed to the big three, generally.
Yeah.
And because you're not aware of it, certainly doesn't mean that they're not giving out your credit reports to all kinds of people, whoever's asking for it.
Yep.
Same thing as the other three. So I didn't mean to interrupt or anything, but I just wanted everybody to be aware of that. And because people are not aware of it in general, they haven't been sued for their multiple bad doings in the past either. But that could change, right, Larry?
I think it is changing. Yeah, no, that's good information. By the way, NCTUE stands for National Consumer Telecom and Utilities Exchange. Their website is www.nctue.com. And we would urge, and we have before, it's been a while, to get a copy of your disclosure report from them. And you can do that simply by calling 866-349-5185. It's very simple to get it. You know, you call within 2 or 3 minutes, you can get what you need, get the form if necessary, and send it back, and you'll get it back almost immediately. But I found that Equifax has pulled my NCTUE report, I think at last count it was like 91 times. Some ridiculous number. Yeah. And I haven't checked in,
wow.
I haven't checked in almost a year. So I'm going to look again.
Well, you know, I haven't pulled mine but once, and that was back when I was in the litigation with Midland, maybe halfway through, so that was several years ago. And I had my hands full at the time, so I really didn't do anything with it. It was out of curiosity that I did it. But I do remember when I obtained it that there was a lot of erroneous, incorrect information in it.
Huh. Which, of course, you know, if you dispute it, makes them subject to FCRA.
Exactly.
So my theory is based on experience, limited experience, and information from a few other people, is that when you sue Equifax, they start pulling your NCTUE report. I don't know if you know anything more about it at this point, Terry, but that's my working theory.
There are some things I know that I can't talk about.
Yeah.
But I will say, and this is interesting, it's different with NCTUE in the way that they collect your data and the way they share it. Unlike with the big three, you might see in a trade line a payment history, or at least partial one. Like I'm thinking of, often you see that with mortgages and credit cards, you know, on the months that were paid, et cetera. Well, with the NCTUE, it lists your utilities and your, you know, phones, et cetera, and it's a very detailed payment history. Okay. Now, the reason I know that a lot of that information that was in mine looked like it was just made up out of thin air is only because I keep very good records and very close track of my utility bills, the exact day I pay them every month, and how I pay them, whether it's online or I go to Walmart and pay it or I mail it in or however it is I'm paying it, even over the phone, even the time of day I did it. And that's because Terry's anal and we all know it. But that's why I know. So I look at that and then I look at my records and I'm like, well, whoopee, because not only do I know that you had to have made this whole damn thing up, I have the exact payment records that I have meticulously kept. And I do that every month. As those utility bills come in, or the phone, or whatever it is, hell, even the rent, as it comes in, I make a list of when I got it, what day it's due, how much it's going to be, and as I pay those things, I mark them off the list and put the date and the times and the way I paid them. And I have that list each and every month, and it gets filed with the pay stubs, you know, the utility payment stubs, et cetera.
Right.
So you might want to think about starting to keep track of way I do. It's not difficult. because if you go get your NCTUE, you just might find a whole lot that doesn't look right to you, but it's going to be a lot harder to prove it if you don't keep good track of things.
Yep. Keeping track of things is very important for all number of reasons.
Right.
There's no such thing as too much evidence.
No, even if you don't use it, you never know.
Well, that's my point. You know, gather everything. You know, we always talk about, like, the TCPA, write down all the details. It's the same thing here with this stuff. Just put down the details so that if you ever question about it, if you get involved in litigation, you can pinpoint and say, well, yes, I made this record on the day that I paid that bill. That's when I wrote this down, so I know for a fact it was paid at, you know, around 10:30 at Walmart or whatever.
So, yeah. Anyway, there definitely is a connection between NCTUE and Equifax. I think Equifax is the repository of their information. Maybe you know, Terry, or I don't know if you can tell us at this point.
I would, without sharing things I'm not supposed to, I would say, gee, Larry, that's a really good guess.
It's a slightly educated guess. I don't have any direct proof of
yeah.
it, but
I would say you must have gotten some see-through glue to your crystal ball.
Yeah. Well, good for me. Anyway, let me give everybody the information on this again, because it's so simple to get this, and it could be potentially very interesting and worth a lot of money. But nctue.com. Phone number 866-349-5185. Give them a call, everybody. See what you get.
And don't forget LexisNexis. Do that regularly every year. And remember, with LexisNexis, you have to ask separately for the NSF report, which is the credit part of the data they keep on you.
Very good. Well, thank you, Larry. That's a lot of great information there, and you know, I'm glad you had some positive result on that appeal. That's always good. You know, we've had a number of our moderators that have won appeals at the federal appellate level. Larry multiple times. John has as well. So, you know, Terry has, of course. I was not so fortunate in the one appeal that I did to the Fifth Circuit, but I was trying to push the envelope on something, and unfortunately I didn't get what I wanted, but you don't know if you don't try. So,
double congrats, Larry, because Equifax is just a burr under my saddle and on my list right now, so I'm glad you are going after them.
Yeah, I mean, the funny thing is, Equifax, my credit report with them is pristine. There's really no issues other than I want to get rid of a bunch of year-old inquiries. But they still owe me money, and they're going to pay it.
There you go. Well, who else has got some good news for us? Any of the moderators? John, you got anything? Or Terry?
That's it, brother. Just plugging along. I guess my good news is, because we've had a lot of new callers, I'm doing the webinar tomorrow, and it is I Got Sued, Now What? So if you haven't joined, you join now, because you can get on the webinar tomorrow.
There you go. Yep, that's good. And then 2 weeks from tomorrow, I'll be doing the webinar, and I'm going to be throwing some tips out on doing settlement agreements to cover your butt. So that's what's coming up the next couple of weeks on the webinars. All right. Well, I tell you what.
That's something, Dave, that I just want to interject something there. We can go into it more on my call this Thursday, and I would like you to remind me. But in regard to the full file disclosure cases and the many of them that we have going on right now, we do need to discuss settlement agreements, because there's a lot of confusion and misunderstanding and unpreparedness, I'll just call it that, out there. And we need to clarify some things about settlement agreements and what they're likely to throw at you and why it's not acceptable. So if you would remind me of that, we'll get into depth on that on Thursday.
Okay, I'll try and remember to do that. All right, well, if any of our callers has got any good news they want to share with us, all you got to do is hit the one key on the keypad in your phone. That'll put you in the queue. We'd love to hear your good news. And if we don't have anybody do that, then we're going to go straight into Q&A. And we will start taking people's questions. I don't see anybody popping their hands up for good news. So with that said, anybody who's got questions, hit the one key on the keypad on your phone. That'll put you in the queue. And we will take the callers in the order that they pop up. Please keep in mind, if we don't have more callers with questions, we will wrap the call up early. We're not here to hear ourselves talk all night long. We're here to try and help people and answer questions. So it's time to be on the ball and hit the one key on the keypad in your phone if you've got a question. And keep in mind, especially for new people that are listening, the only stupid question is the one that you don't ask, because you don't get an answer to it. And, you know, don't think that, oh, well, I don't want to embarrass myself and sound really stupid on that call. Please keep in mind that every one of us, every one of the moderators on here, started at the same place as everybody else. We didn't know anything about this. There's a starting point for every single one of us. We're just farther along in
Absolutely.
The educational process, and we're willing to share that knowledge with you free of charge right here. You know, you don't have to keep sticking nickels or dimes or quarters in your computer to stay on here or into your phone to listen to it. You know, your phone company is not charging you, you know, 50 cents a minute to listen to us to get information. But the whole idea of these calls is to help people out and give you an idea of what we do, how we can answer questions for you. Because, you know, there's many times when we're trying to learn something when we would, you know, not necessarily when we're under the gun, but just, you know, we're curious about things. And if we knew we had a place to go where somebody was knowledgeable about something, and not the BS line, but actually knowledgeable, somebody that actually has experience that we could actually talk to, we could actually ask them questions and have a conversation with them. I mean, wouldn't it be nice if you could be able to do that with everybody?
We'd still go to this day, Dave.
Yeah,
we had somebody, any attorney that helps us or does that, we immediately set up calls, we talk, we learn, you know, and that's us, and we know about it.
Yeah.
We're always looking.
Well,
away.
That's the thing. You know we study, but we also talk to attorneys on a regular basis.
Yep.
We learn from them. They learn from us. It's a mutual exchange between us and the attorneys that we work with, and it's a very beneficial relationship that we have with them. So keep that in mind. You know, there's plenty of BS out on the internet. This is not the BS line. This is where you can get good information. Well, I'll tell you what, we got somebody that popped a hand up here and there in area code 808, and they are unmuted. Go ahead with your question.
I have a question. Is there any way to get old student loans off your credit report or get them discharged?
Terry? Larry?
I don't like the word discharge in that statement, Dave.
Well, okay.
I'm sorry, I was muted. I had to unmute. If they are federally backed, the only way you're going to get out of them at all is if you are permanently disabled, okay? If they are privately funded, not a government loan, and they go to collection, there may be a way fighting through collection on the private ones. But with the federal loans, now you can still go after debt collectors and their wrongdoing, but getting that loan forgiven or erased is, at current, pretty much impossible, unless you're
disabled.
You
can thank Bill Clinton for that, unfortunately.
Absolutely.
He was the one that did that.
Now,
but
I know that the little birds in my ear tell me that there may be big changes on that front over, let's say, the next little over 6 years, if you get my drift.
Yeah, well,
but
well,
I don't
I'll
see
say
it as real soon. Yeah, I mean, I know that that is one of the issues on his plate and in his agenda, but considering the far large that he's dealing with right now, I wouldn't look to see any major changes on that front in the next year, at least. Would you, Dave?
Yeah, I'm not going to even begin to talk about a time frame, but suffice it to say that he definitely is very aware of that problem, the enormity of it, and they are looking at it. Now, how fast that's moving along, I don't know, but it's not something that's being ignored by any stretch of the imagination. So,
no, it is on the agenda.
Okay, thank you.
You're welcome.
All right. That answer your question?
Yes. I had read an article in, I think it was like New York Times, that the student loans were having the same challenge that the mortgage securitization had, and that they had sold a lot of student loans, and when taken to court, they had a difficult time proving anyone owned them. Are you familiar with that? And if is there
on the private ones, on the privately funded ones, absolutely. I have seen a lot of that, and that's why I said you have some recourse there and some possibilities, and I'm not an expert in that because, well, I don't have any student loans, and I don't really delve into that area for the same reason I don't with the mortgages, because I don't have one. But I have seen a lot of really interesting cases and twists, and I would continue to research that if that's an issue in your life, and compare strategies, et cetera, on the cases that have been going on lately, especially on that securitization thing. You're right about that. But like I said, when it comes to the federally funded ones, you're not going to get anywhere with it. They securitize everything like all the rest of them do, but they're not going to admit to it. But
no.
If it's privately funded, I would go down that route.
I appreciate that. Thank you.
Yeah, you really need to check which loan you have. If it is private, one strategy, which I have done, I mean, I didn't do this exactly, so ignore that last statement. If you default on a private loan and it goes to a collection agency, anytime anything goes to a collection agency, that's money in your pocket. Let's put it that way. But you will take a hit, at least temporarily, on your credit report. And it depends on the amount of the loan. If it's significant, then they're probably going to sue you for it. So, you know, be cautious. In my case, I sued my student loan company, and not only did they X out the loan, they just eliminated it completely. They paid me money on top of that. Now, it was a relatively small loan, but still.
What was the grounds of the lawsuit?
It was the typical FCRA, FDCPA violations with both the company that had the student loan and collection agencies.
Great. Thank you.
Okay. Does that answer your questions?
Yes. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. All right. said before, if we don't have hands up, well, you know, I think we can roll up the carpet and say goodnight, everybody, because I don't see any other hands up. So I'm going to make one more call here. If there's anybody that has questions for us, hit the one key on the keypad on your phone. You know, it's past the end of summer. You know, I'm surprised we've got a number of people, but maybe we don't have too many people that have got issues right now that they need answers to questions on. But now's the time to speak or forever hold your peace. We have somebody that popped up here from 347. And as soon as the board moves, there we go. You're unmuted. Go ahead with your question.
Yeah, the question is, how would you deal with a 12B6 motion? It's a motion for summary judgment.
That's not a 12B6.
Oh, no, it's not 12B. So it's summary judgment. I think it's not 12B6, but it's
okay.
Summary judgment, yeah.
Well, how do you deal with a motion for summary judgment? Well, you have to oppose it. You do an opposition to it. You have to address all of the points that they make in their motion. And one of the most important things that you have to keep in mind when you do an opposition to a motion for summary judgment, they have to put an affidavit with their motion, and you must put an affidavit in with your opposition to that motion to counter the points that they are making in their affidavit. If you don't, you're just dead meat.
And in order to prevail on an opposition to a motion for summary judgment, you must establish that there is at least one material fact issue before the court that must be decided by the trier of fact, either the judge or the jury.
Right.
All you need is one to defeat it. So you never know which one is going to be the strongest in the discretion and eyes of the court and in your argument, etc. You just never know. So you want to go point by point, each and every one of their arguments, and give it your absolute best counter argument.
Right. Do you have to have any case laws to back up your... argument?
It depends on what your argument is, and that depends on what their argument is. So case law is specifically cued to individual issues, and nobody's are the same.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. You know, we might have the same exact fact pattern even, or issues in a lawsuit, you and I, and our complaints are going to be different. The exact arguments we get from the opposing side, whatever attorneys they have, are probably going to be wildly different, even if the worthless case law they're using might even be the same. We've seen a lot of that with the CRAs, Equifax in particular. But they may structure their objections and their arguments, even on the same issue, completely different than they do with mine, and they may cite different case law. Now, you have to deal with the case law they cite. So if they say your complaint should fail because ABC based on XYZ versus 123, 1973, okay, then you have to go find that case, read why it is they think that's analogous to yours, and does it even support their argument? Because a lot of times... that they'll cite stuff that doesn't even have anything to do with their argument.
And in other cases, they will cherry pick dicta out of the decision and make it sound like it's supporting their position, where in reality it actually supports your position. That's why you have to go and read those cases very carefully and think about
right.
exactly what's being said there, because they turn that stuff around all the time. I think most of the moderators would agree with me that we probably see that close to 50% of the time.
Well, right, and I tell you, even at the appeal level, never put it past an attorney on the other side not to take things so far out of context that they will actually quote a citation from another case and deliberately leave out the most important word in the citation that makes it like that citation may be completely exculpatory in your favor, but by leaving out one word, it makes it exculpatory in their favor. So I don't care who the law firm is, don't put it past them, because they will do it.
The affidavit, but if you got to do the affidavit, it's a debt collector, and it's basically two credit pulls. I don't see how I'm going to have the affidavit. I mean, because I don't really have any documents to produce an affidavit.
An affidavit is your statement of firsthand fact knowledge.
Right.
That's all it is.
You can make your affidavit as to when you obtained your credit report on such and such a date, you found that the defendant had, it showed the defendant had obtained your credit report on such and such a date. You know, these kind of things, like that, maybe they're saying, oh, it's past statute of limitations or something like that. That's
mm-hmm.
how you document all those kind of things. But here again, if you don't do an affidavit, that's a requirement in dealing with summary judgment.
Yeah. Doesn't matter what the facts are, just that your affidavit contains nothing but facts, all the facts and nothing but the facts, no opinion, no conclusions or belief in an affidavit. Only the absolute bare facts to your firsthand fact knowledge. Now, like following what Dave just said, like if it, what they're saying, well, you know, statute of limitations has passed on that, and so you can't sue us. But remember, with the FCRA, which of course is what that all comes under, that 2 years is from the date of your discovery, not the date in which they did it. Now, generally, most credit reporting agencies, they're usually pretty good about it, eliminating credit pulls after 2 years, because most of them, that's the longest they stay on there, is 2 years, and they usually will dump them. But I say usually, and they're better about it now than they used to be, because I can say with firsthand knowledge, in 2012, they were listing credit pulls on mine that were, you know, 4 or 5 years old.
Well, another thing that you look at when you're doing an affidavit is you can state in your affidavit, plaintiff at no time gave consent for XYZ company to obtain his credit report.
Oh.
See, that is a statement of fact, because they may be saying, oh, well, you gave consent because of this or that. You are establishing right there through sworn testimony that you're putting in with your opposition that you did not. You're raising an issue of material fact before the court.
Right. Now, the Versafire Consultant is claiming that they have permission to pull the credit because the court have ruled in their favor that it's lawful for a debt collector to go and pull your credit.
Okay, hold on there. Hold on right there. In a way, they're right. Many courts have ruled that debt collectors can pull your credit report, but there is a caveat. And if it is not brought up in front of that court, then that ruling doesn't count. And here is the caveat. The FCRA clearly gives a permissible purpose to a collector if and only if they are doing it on behalf of the creditor. So in other words, if they are a traditional third-party debt collector, they have been retained by the collector, and they have a contract, with the creditor, and they have a contract with the creditor, they do have a permissible purpose. But if they are a debt buyer, they do not, because they are not doing it on behalf of a creditor.
So the first of our concern, is it a contract that they have with the creditor? Is it a debt buyer?
Yes. Okay. A debt buyer is not a creditor, is not a collector. It is a down-the-line buyer. Okay? Now, they often will take the stand that they are the creditor because they bought it and now they own it. Well, that's not true either, because they can't buy an account. What they buy is fragmented information, okay? They do not buy an account. All they buy is the right to collect if you're dumb enough to pay them. Okay, they're not creditors, and I have established that in my appeals case with the 11th Circuit. So, and you should quote from it if you're dealing with a debt buyer. That's a debt buyer. Now, a regular collector, a traditional third-party debt collector, okay, they are always assigned to collect by a creditor. They don't own it. They're not themselves creditors, nor do they usually present themselves to be, because they're not. They have an agreement, a payment agreement with the creditor. Like, for instance, they make a deal with Capital One Bank to collect a credit card, and if they collect on it, they get to keep 40% of what they collect. That would be a contingency contract. There is always an agreement somewhere. So if they're claiming that they had a permissible purpose as a traditional third-party debt collector because a creditor hired them, and they haven't presented any proof that that's true, then it is improper to grant a summary judgment at this point without discovery, where you can go after that contract. It's one thing for them to say, yeah, well, Capital One hired us to collect this credit card account. Really? Well, then pony it up. Let's see that agreement.
Where's the evidence of it?
Exactly. But remember, if it turns out that you are dealing with a legitimate third party contingency collector, then they may have permissible purpose, and the court will find in their favor, because it's listed as a permissible purpose specifically.
So a company, right, so I was saying a company like Inclusify Consultants, are they a debt buyer? Is it a contract?
That one, I don't know. Dave, do you know, are they or not?
I do not. Yeah, I do not believe Diversified is a debt buyer. I believe they're a contingency collector. I have never seen anything anywhere that indicates they are a debt buyer.
Oh, wow. So they're working on behalf.
Now, that's it could very well be. Now, we can't say for absolutely sure. We don't know if they don't occasionally buy things. You know, if we haven't dealt with them ourselves and conducted in-depth discovery to find out, Dave and I are not going to categorically say, no, they never do, because we don't know. and I don't have any experience with them. But at this point, if you've gotten all the way to a summary judgment, has there been discovery already?
No, they haven't. There's been...
Okay. Now, keep in mind, you're in it for... you're already in it, right? So you're going to have to fight it to the best of your ability. So it may turn out that they are a legitimate... They have a legitimate agreement with whomever they were collecting for, and they have a permissible purpose. If they do, they do. You can't erase that. However... If there's been no discovery, them saying it doesn't prove it. So if that is one of the legs of their motion for summary judgment, he doesn't have a ground to sue us because, of course, we have a permissible purpose. We're doing it on behalf of a creditor.
Right.
Well, it's one thing to say that. But your counterargument can be that they have presented no factual evidence or proof on the record that they were A, hired by XYZ, whatever company, and B, that they were hired on behalf of XYZ, whatever company, on an account directly related to you.
Right.
See, they not only have to prove they have a contingency agreement with XYZ creditor, but they've got to be able to prove that maybe that's a blanket agreement. Maybe they do all their collections. You don't know. A lot of them do use the same company or same two or three companies all the time. But that doesn't mean that you... and an account belonging to you, which has an accurate balance on it, was actually part of that agreement. They've got to produce that.
Right.
So keep that in mind, because you're in it now. You dove into the deep end. You don't want to sink to the bottom. You're just going to have to make the best possible argument you can at this point. Now, just as a cautionary thing, and I'm not criticizing you in any way, but I want to point out to everybody else that knowledge should have been in your head and in your hands before you filed the case. Make sure that you're not filing an impermissible pull against a company that does, in fact, have one. First.
Right. Yeah. Okay. But how would you know if they have one or not?
That's what
you
have
to
go after.
The company and what they do.
Right. And then when you get into discovery, it's, if there's been no discovery, that's generally an improper motion for summary judgment unless they attach their agreement showing that they were hired specifically to collect on an account that they can show belongs to you, blah, blah, blah. If they attach all that to their summary judgment, you're probably not going to beat them on that issue. Okay, well then, if they didn't attach anything, then it's he said, she said. Okay, they haven't presented any factual evidence on the record, and there's been no discovery. Therefore, it is improper for the court to entertain a motion for summary judgment at this stage of litigation, and it should be allowed to go forward to discovery. Once you get into discovery, those are the things you want to force them to produce in discovery.
Right. Normally, to respond to the summary judgment, how long do you have? I mean, a month or 2 weeks? I don't know. Cause I don't,
21
sure.
days, usually.
21 days. So I got
But, again, I want to caution you. You've got to check
your
local rules. And Yeah. You got to check your local rules, and if you have any doubt at all what day the 21 days or 14 days or whatever the court, your court gives, you need to call your clerk and ask.
And federal, I've always gotten 30 days for summary judgment, and for pro se parties, the court will usually tell you specifically.
Right. Okay.
Right, and you can almost always get an extension of time, and don't put in for it too early or too late. For instance, like Larry just said, if the court gives you 30 days to respond, well, you don't want to put in for a motion for an extension of time to respond on the 10th day. You know, you want to wait until, say, the 20th day or even the 25th day. You don't want to wait too close to the deadline, and you want to have a good reason for it. But especially with pro ses, the courts will almost always grant it, at least one.
The most important
thing. And you
thing
do
is
have
to
consult with the other side.
Yeah, you need to know what your rules say.
Go ahead,
because
Dave.
In contrast to what Larry said there, he's always gotten 30 days. And where I am in the Eastern District of Texas, they're very specific. You've got 21 days plus 3 days mailing.
Right.
Okay. So you
yeah,
have to
I
know
only got
rules.
The 21, too. In Georgia, in the Southern District where I was, I only got 21. But I did put in for an extension, and I got it.
Right, and I have done the same.
So the local, so, the federal rules of procedures, civil procedures, but that's one rule. The local rule, is that the same kind of rules that's used in Supreme Court and civil court?
Okay, no. Okay, follow me closely here. You got your federal rules of civil procedure. Okay, then you have your local rules, which pertain only to that court. When you read your local rules, they use the same numbers as the federal rules of civil procedure. And the only ones listed in your local rules are any of the federal rules of civil procedure, which that court wants to change for its own reason. Okay? So it will have the same number on it as the federal rule of civil procedure. It's just that not necessarily all of the federal rules are going to be in the local rules. Only those that are changed or altered in any way by that local court. So you always check your local rules. This is the way I look at it. I check my local rules first. Mm-hmm. Okay? On that rule number that they're citing or you need, that you're using, okay? If that is not in my local rules, then I go to the federal rule because that one applies.
Okay. It defaults to the federal rules if there's nothing in your local rules.
Right.
Exactly. So you always go to your local rules first. And if you just remember that, always go there first. And anything it says in the local rule, that's stone for you. Not for me, but for you. Because that's the court you're in. Okay? But if it's not there, then you go to the federal rule, and that's stone for you.
Okay. Do you have to send a copy of your answer to the clerk? If only
You file the original signature copy with the clerk of your answer or your
response. Opposition.
Response. Your opposition. Yeah, I couldn't think of the word. Of your opposition. Just like anything else that you file with the court, the original signature goes to the court. You have to send a copy to each defendant. Now, in your case, you only got one defendant, but if somebody happens to be in a case, and this is for everybody's benefit, let's say if you've got three different defendants in a case, but you're dealing with, let's say, a motion to dismiss with one of them, When you file your answer to their motion to dismiss or any other filing dealing with one of them, you have to send a copy of that filing to all of the defendants. There's some people, they forget that. They're thinking, oh, well, I don't have to send it to the others. They're not involved in it. Oh, yes, you do. Anybody that's a party to that case has to be served a copy of it. So in your case, there's just one. So, yes, you do have to send a copy to the other side.
Okay.
And don't forget.
All right.
I'm sorry, there was something I was going to. I thought you couldn't hear me there for a second. Okay, because I'm down to one bar on my cell. I got to get back over where I was. Just a minute, Haley. Back over where I was. Don't forget, when you send the copy to the other side, you do not send it to the defendant, you send it to their counsel.
Right.
Whatever their counsel of record is in the case.
Right. Okay, that answer your questions?
Yes.
All righty. You have a great evening.
You too.
Okay. Let's see if we've got anybody else here that managed to pop their hand up in the air. And, you know, I don't see anybody else that has their hand raised. And I'm going to say one more time that if you have a question for us, the way you put yourself in the queue to get your question answered is hit the one key on the keypad in your phone. And if we don't have anybody else that does that, then we're going to go ahead and
call it a night,
wrap
buddy.
Things up. Yeah, well, all of a sudden now we've got a couple more people that have popped hands up. So we'll go to 218. You're unmuted for your question. Go ahead.
Okay, I have a question. If you lost your mortgage and the note in a fire, is there a way to get copies of those?
Your mortgage is public record, so you can go down to your public records office, your county office there, and get it.
Okay. Mortgage and the note?
No. Note is never recorded.
Okay. How would
so
you,
you don't
get...
need the note. Doesn't matter. If you have the mortgage in your hand, you don't need a note.
Okay. Okay, looking at, you know, stalling off a foreclosure on a home, you don't need a copy of the note?
No. They do.
No.
You don't.
Okay.
Yeah, you may get to the point where you want them to produce a copy of the note, but you don't have to produce that.
And the mortgage would be recorded in your local county courthouse?
You got it. Yep.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Yep.
All right. You're very welcome.
Okay.
Okay. And we're going to go to 312. As soon as the board moves here, there we go. 312, you're unmuted for your question. Go ahead. Hello, 312. And your hand up. Maybe you need to unmute your phone because we're not hearing you. And we're still not hearing them. So evidently they don't want to talk to us.
Hello.
So I guess.
There you go.
Okay. Now, are you there? I just unmuted you again.
Okay. Can you hear me now?
312. Yeah, we can hear you. Go ahead.
Okay. Yeah, I have a my name is James. I have a complaint for a permissible pull under for the credit buyer or debt buyer, and I'm using 1681 S2B. And my question is each one of those sentences in that?
Wait! Stop right there! S2B does not apply to a credit pull.
that's failure to investigate.
Okay.
That's failure to investigate on a trade line. The only thing you can go after him for on a credit pull is an impermissible pull. That's not S2B.
So that's 1681B, A?
Yeah.
Am I correct? Okay.
It's not an S2B.
So, but if I sent them a debt validation and they failed to validate, then it would be the S2B.
No,
you don't.
Debt validation doesn't have anything to. Okay, debt validation is FDCPA for one thing. It's not even the same statute, and that does not create an S2B. You have to understand what an S2B is. It is only one thing ever, and that is failure to investigate a dispute properly. For the furnisher, it's S2B. If it's the credit reporting agency, it's IA. But that's the only issue that comes under that, is a failure to investigate a dispute. And FDCPA, that is where failure to validate and then continuing to try to collect comes in, but it's still FDCPA, not FCRA.
Okay. Okay, so that's why I got that 12B6 motion. See, now, because it was kind of confusing for me that they sent that 12B6 motion to dismiss. And so I see now.
Well, depending on how you wrote your complaint, it sounds like you're confused.
Right, I am. Because I was claiming the, I was claiming that they failed I was using. Okay, so from my complaint, I was using 1681BF. Yeah.
As?
Yeah.
As what?
Let me get to it. Yeah, BF. Certain use or obtaining of information prohibited, a person shall not use or obtain a consumer report for any purpose unless, one, a consumer report is obtained for a purpose for which the consumer report is authorized to be furnished under this section, and two, the purpose is certified in accordance with 1681E by a prospective user of the report.
Okay, in order to go after the E violation, once again, that involves discovery, where you have to force them and the CRA to fork up, you know, cough up the certification. That's hard to do, but it can be done. So you did put it under the correct impermissible pull thing. But if they're a debt buyer, well, they definitely don't have a permissible purpose if, and only if, that credit pull happened after they purchased that account data. If they did it in anticipation before they purchased the portfolio where they got that information to begin with, there's a permissible purpose. But if it was afterwards, and it almost always is, there's no permissible purpose. But once again, you have to get into discovery to prove that, because you've got to make them cough up the contract so that you can look at the date of the purchase or even the bill of sale, and they'll almost always fork that over with no fight whatsoever. You look on the bill of sale, and let's say on the bill of sale, it shows they bought the portfolio June 12th of 2016. And then you look on your credit report, and it shows that the credit pull happened in April of 2017. Well, obviously it wasn't before the purchase, right?
Right.
So then you've got them, because that's the only time they have a permissible purpose. It has been established now that they are not collectors. So that rule giving a permissible purpose to collectors doesn't apply to them. They are not creditors. So the rule giving a creditor a permissible purpose to pull it for their own collection, you know, on a transaction that you initiated, doesn't apply to them. So the only rule that they're left with is they get to pull it in anticipation of a purchase, not after a purchase.
Right.
So let me just tell you. Yeah, but now.
But I got to prove it.
Okay.
I got to prove it by getting them to give me the certification, or the general or the specific certification that the.
I don't know what their argument is in their 12B6. What they're basing it on? What are they saying? Oh, we were trying to collect, and therefore we have a permissible purpose. Is that what they're saying?
Yeah, they use 1681. They use 1681B, A3, I think it is. Or they're trying to say that they're a creditor, and that they had a permissible pull.
BA3A. Okay, yeah, they're trying to hide behind that. Go and read the ruling I got out of the 11th Circuit. Jesse, I believe it's even on the website somewhere, isn't it, that ruling?
Yes. Yep.
Okay. Go and read it, and read it carefully. Hinkle versus Midland. Okay. Right. And the arguments you'll need are in there, even though we weren't drilling down on the permissible purpose thing. But if you, and then read the 40 years doc, start on page 44 and read through where it specifically spells out what the permissible purposes are for creditors, collectors, and it doesn't say debt buyers. It talks about resellers, which a debt buyer is, and you'll get the arguments you need directly out of that, out of the 40-year stock. And you're going to have to, when you do your opposition to their 12B6, deal with each argument as they brought it forth in order, if you can. Each particular item, you're going to have your argument back, and part of that argument is defendant states they had a permissible purpose as a collector. However, as has been established by the 11th Circuit under Hinkle versus Midland, defendants, by their own admission, are in fact down the line debt buyers, and therefore are not creditors or collectors, and BA3A would therefore not apply to them.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And what permissible purpose they may be able to establish must be pursued in the discovery process and should not be, you know, decided at the motion to dismiss stage.
Oh, okay.
You follow me there? But you really, really need to understand the differences that I just explained to you in order to get, because remember, I tell everybody, your job, you only have one job in all of this, and that is to make the court see the facts and the case through your eyes. And if your glasses are dirty and you can't even see clearly through them, you're not going to get that court to see it.
Mm-hmm. I had a motion to determine that the other
party was in default because they answered the complaint late, past the date to answer the complaint.
Yeah, well, the court's going to let them get away with it, unless they were egregiously late, in which case you could have filed for a court's default, a clerk's default.
They wouldn't that, but they totally ignored everything I sent to them. They even ignored
waiver. That's bad behavior, and the court is, of course, just not going to smack them for it. And if they were late in responding to even coming into the case and answering the complaint, unless they were late enough and you put in a motion for a clerk's default, then the court's going to say, well, why didn't you say something then? The court's not even going to entertain it. And even if you did, it's their discretion. The court can come back and say, yeah, well, you know, they had a pretty good reason. We're going to let them do it. And that's what they usually do, right, Dave?
Yeah, well, and what the court does on things like that is the court wants to see cases adjudicated on the merits, not on a technicality of, oh, well, you were a day or 2 days late filing your answer to the complaint. They want to see the case adjudicated based on the merits of the case. So, you know, if they're a little late filing, they're going to let them do it.
Yeah, the only time that there's any really notable exceptions to that is if the court orders them specifically by written order or oral instruction in a teleconference or in open court to do something by a particular date and then they don't do it. Yeah, that's a different story. But if it's just that they missed a deadline set forth by the rules and it's not like 6 months, you know, the court's generally going to let them get away with it.
Right. So
now, I think that's part of the magistrate's attitude towards Equifax in my case, because they really were egregious. They didn't enter into the case, never did enter into the case until after an amended complaint was filed and several motions to dismiss and to strike and all kinds of stuff had gone back and forth, and the case had an amended complaint had been served and accepted by the court. Then they deem it proper to finally come in the case. And I think that's ticked my magistrate off a bit, but I didn't push it. I didn't need to. I let them, you know, make their own problems with the judge.
Well,
sometimes you just want to do that.
Yeah, one last thing to talk about. Fear. Approaching
the
bench.
Fear? Well, you know, it's like my dad said, in any soldier who goes into a gun battle and a gunfight and doesn't have a healthy dose of fear is a moron. You know, your fear is usually what keeps you alive and on your toes.
Well, thank you for that. Good to hear that. Because I keep getting up and trying.
Well, think about it.
I haven't stopped trying, but get fearful sometimes.
Just take a deep breath and, you know, ask Dave. I'm no stranger to that. And he will tell you how many times he peeled me off the ceiling, you know, and tells me, now, Terry, you need to just put this away and go to bed or go do something with Haley or go for a bike ride, go for a swim, read a book, do something, get the hell away from it, and come back later.
Yeah.
How many times, Dave, you can't even count.
I wore out two scrapers peeling her off the ceiling.
There you go.
Plenty of times, believe me. More than more than we want to even begin to get into a discussion about. But, yeah,
so
but that's all part of things. Keep after it.
That's the other sad thing is, so nervous they thought they won the case, right? So I talked to him a little bit later.
Yeah, you know, I might have been scared shitless, but I walked away a victor.
Yeah. Oh, believe me, Terry rode the roller coaster. She rode
and
it far
really
longer
did.
Than anybody I've ever known.
I know. I should get some kind of prize for that roller coaster.
Yes, you should.
Actually, I did.
You did. Well,
everybody
you
got
did.
A prize.
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. The whole country got a prize for me riding that roller coaster.
Yep, that's true. All right. Have we answered your questions for you?
Yeah. Thank you all a lot. I really enjoyed this. Thank you guys a lot.
All righty. Thank you. You have
You're
a great
welcome.
Evening.
All right.
Okay. And one more time. If there's anybody that has a question, you hit that one key in the keypad in your phone, or we're done. And I'm going to give 3 seconds. 1, 2, 3. I don't see any more hands, so we're done for tonight, folks.
Sold.
Yes.
Sold.
I want to remind everybody that tomorrow afternoon at 3 o'clock Eastern Time, John is doing a webinar. I've been sued. What do I do now? That's
run.
The place for you to be. What's that?
I said run.
Oh,
you get sued.
Yeah,
oh, my
run.
God, run.
Yep. Yeah, it's that's at 3 o'clock
yeah.
tomorrow afternoon. So, you know, John's going to help you out with that kind of stuff. So if you've got specific questions, you know, if you think even maybe you might be having something like that coming and you want to kind of prepare, that's a good time to discuss it because he'll have more time to do that. Then, of course, the rest of the week, all the members get to use the website, the forum. You can post your questions, get your answers, and you can go back and study 20, probably close to 30,000 postings at this point.
It's getting up there.
In there. It's all, yeah, it's all broken down by subject matter. So if you've got a specific area that you're interested in learning things about, you can just go in there and study it like it's a library, you know, saving your home section, the TCPA section, taking their money. There's probably a ton of questions in there that you would never even think about asking, much less having gotten an answer to. So if you're wanting to learn, there's a lot of good information in there. I encourage everybody to go do that. And then, of course, next week, we no longer do Dallas Debt Discussion on Monday nights. Talk Shoe screwed up the works, so that's done in perpetuity. And next week, we'll have Terry's call, but we have Terry's call this week, as usual. That's on Thursday night. And that is at 8 o'clock Eastern Time. And if you're not on Terry's email list for some strange reason, send an email to queensongbird, that's all one word, queensongbird@gmail.com, and just say, please put me on the list. She'll send you a reminder of the calls just one time. So take and mark that information somewhere after you get that email, because she doesn't send a reminder out to everybody every week because of the mass email situation she has. So there's lots of help out here. You guys have to do it yourselves, but we're here to help you. We don't do it for you. And with that said, Jesse, I'm going to turn it over to you to wrap it up.
I just want to thank you guys, the moderators. Of course, we can't do it without you. It felt kind of strange to not have the time given for the Dallas call. Just sounded weird, David, just so you know.
Yeah. Well, it's over 9 years.
It screwed up my
Dallas
week so bad. I went bowling last night instead.
There you go.
Yeah.
And I bowled the worst I've ever bowled in my life. It's all Dave's fault.
That's right.
Yep. I got a sore hip, but I
got
broad shoulders, so
man.
I'll handle it.
There you go. And a broken rib. You're a tough dude, man. So,
man.
Anyway, guys, God bless everybody. Dave, again, thank you for heading it up as you do. And then don't miss the webinar tomorrow at 3 o'clock. We'll see you there, guys. You have a good night.
Good night.
Thank you, guys.
Have a great week, everybody.
Good night, all.